dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva or WXXE Fenner, Syracuse. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. Tonight in our first hour, we're going to conclude our series on biotechnology with an examination of the tactics and propaganda mechanisms being used by the biotech industry to push their products on an unwilling or unknowing public. In the second hour, we'll take a look at the relationship of religion and politics. Concluding our December biotech series that we've been running for the past 3 weeks here on the show, we're going to bring you three speakers from a symposium called Big Money, Bad Science that took place last month in Vancouver, British Columbia. First, activist, economist, farmer, author, and theologian Brewster Neen is going to speak on the tactics of the Biotech Industry Government Alliance to propagate the commercialization of biotech products. Next, we'll hear from Donald Gutstein of Newswatch Canada, who will trace the trajectory of the biotech industry's $50 million propaganda campaign and the role of the press. The third panelist will be Tony Clark, director of the Polaris Institute of Canada, who will speak on the engines that are driving biotech on a global scale. All of the presenters in the panel are Canadian and refer to Canadian government agencies, organizations, and media outlets during their presentations. However, the USDA and other U.S. government agencies maintain similar relationships with the biotech industry as their Canadian counterparts. Major universities, such as Cornell in Ithaca, are involved in partnerships with the biotech industry and defend it zealously as well. The mechanism of propaganda and influence is the same in either country. Once you understand how the mechanism works, it won't work on you. First, Brewster Neen.
He is an activist, theologist, and economist. His most recent book, Farmageddon, he has published several books, but you're probably most familiar with Farmageddon. And Brewster is also working on building sustainable communities. So let's get started with Brewster.
Yeah, lots of people here. Good. I can't see anything but the lights, really. Okay, we're short of time. We've got a lot to do today. We've got to organize the global resistance, or I should say we've got to work on the development of resistance to herbicides and genetic engineering and things like that. So really my message basically is practice being good weeds. Because that's what we need to do, like the dandelions and the springtime coming up through the concrete and so on. That's supposed to be the punchline, but it came out first. And I want you to note, yesterday I was speaking in a debate with Dennis Avery, and I looked around the room and I said, there's 200 delegates to the United Grain Growers, and there's two women in the audience out of the 200. Well, you've got three men talking about genetic engineering, a decidedly male project. But fortunately, we have at least one woman on stage at the same time. So we're going to have to redress this kind of imbalance in our thinking in a whole lot of other ways. I haven't got a graphic, which I wish I had. I'm going to have to create one, because in thinking about where we are, we need to come up with a new image for the double helix. You know, it's supposed to be the two strands of DNA twisting together. But I think what we're really dealing with here today is the fact that the double helix, actually, if you didn't realize it, consists of one strand of DNA and one strand of TNC, and they're intertwined. And when they connect properly, you get a patented product, and so on. Anyway, I want to tell a little story about a strategic alliance. That's what the business likes to call these things these days, to illustrate where we are. In 1997, I was invited to participate in the seminar for high school teachers organized by Canadian Institute of Biotechnology. Well, actually, it was the Key Foundation for High School Teachers. And this is a industry-funded project to bring high school teachers from across the country, particularly science teachers, for kind of a period of indoctrination. And Rick Walder wanted me. They figured to have credibility with the science, they need to have some balance, so I was there. But I heard a most interesting story as part of a one of the sessions that Margaret Gadsby from AgriVo spent about 45 minutes explaining how segregation of genetically engineered crops was utterly impossible. You couldn't do it in the seeds, you couldn't do it on a farm, you couldn't do it in grain storage, you couldn't do it anywhere. And then she concluded her 45-minute monologue on this stuff with a comment that, besides, when the horse is gone, it's too late to fix the stable door. Well, Ray Molling from Monsanto was also in the room, and I said, thank you, Margaret, and I'm glad Ray is here because you just confirmed what I thought, namely that what we are seeing is a concerted industry strategy carefully worked out to push as much genetically engineered product out there as fast as possible before the public realizes what's being put over on them. And I waited. And neither of them said a thing. Well, the story is in Farmageddon, too, and nobody's ever questioned it. Nobody's ever taken me to task for repeating that. So I now pass it on to you, because I think what we're seeing and what that indicated was the kind of collusion between the regulatory agency, Agriculture Canada, then the CFIA, and the industry from day one. It goes back to 1983 in Canada, when the industry and the government got together and established the biotech strategy for Canada. So that you've had a regulatory agency for all that time whose mission, and it's in the director, it's in the contradictory mandate of the CFIA, and it was in Agriculture Canada before that, to regulate and promote both. That's not quite the terminology to use, but if you read it, you'll see what it is. And it's the promotional side of it that's always taken precedence. So you've had a regulatory agency deeply committed a priori to the biotech industry and to getting as much out there as fast as possible. Last spring, I mean, it does cause some problems. Last spring, when Monsanto kind of quietly pointed out that one of their Roundup Ready soybeans contained two novel gene constructs that had not been approved or even known about before, the CFIA's response, that should have been regulating this and finding out whether they knew what it should have in the first place, insisted that Monsanto actually know what it was they're putting out, and the CFIA, in fact, ought to have investigated that. Their response was, well, nothing's happened, so I guess it's okay. So much for our regulatory agencies, but it does illustrate the kind of collusion that exists. The latest chapter in this, of course, is Starlink. And all of a sudden, Starlink and this corn that's turned up all over the place, containing a CRY9 gene that is not approved for human food use, it was approved for animal, and one has to wonder about this. This has been out there for 3 years. This is the third year it's been grown. Aventis knew all along that this gene was not approved for human food use. And the FDA obviously did, and yet it's out there. And frankly, I think that what we're seeing in this with the Starlink is another exercise in trying to flood the market very deliberately, taking a gamble that they can get that out there and so pollute the system that they can say there's no going back. I see a consistent strategy on the part of industry right from beginning to end on this. And of course, as the industry is consolidated, you've got fewer and fewer players, having such a coordinated strategy becomes easier and easier. You don't have to talk to very many people to have a conspiracy. And with a movement between regulatory and industry people, that makes it even easier. So you have now we've got to the point where Aventis wants to have the FDA say, well, describe Starlink as an unavoidable contaminant. And we won't do it again, and we won't produce any more of it, but give us 4 years for it to work through the system. Now, the interesting thing about Starlink was that it wasn't approved, and I was on a panel with a guy from Monsanto in Winnipeg a couple of weeks ago, and he was going on this line about how thoroughly tested these new crops are. He said they're tested against every known allergen. And I had just said, preceding him, that, of course, the reason Starlink wasn't approved was they said, here is a novel protein that we don't know whether it's allergenic or not, because there's nothing to compare it to. And that's why they said, we don't know whether this is allergenic or not. There's no way to know other than doing some testing of actually putting it out there. So that's, in fact, what's happened. They've put it out there to see, was anybody going to react? But if it's not labeled and it's everywhere, you can't prove the point. You can't bring a case against them. Now, I don't think this is accidental either. I think what the refusal of the industry to have labeling and the whole strategy has been geared to avoiding liability. They know they're heading for trouble at some point. But if you can't identify it, if you can't pin it down, how do you take them to court for libel? Or for liability, I mean. Maybe libel too, I don't know. But I think that's another thing in terms of industry strategy that we need to keep in mind. Well, the other, so much for that. I want to talk for a few minutes, trying to keep my eye on the clock here, because I do want to make the point here that we, at our peril, regard genetic engineering as unique, that as somehow biotechnology is an aberration from the norm of our culture. On the contrary, I want to suggest to you that genetic engineering is an extreme expression of the culture that that image represents. Namely, a culture which has viewed for a long time nature as its enemy. You can go back to Bacon or you can trace it back. You can play lots of games trying to where did this come from. But the whole notion that nature is our enemy, that we must conquer and control and dominate, and that's really our major goal in life, is so deep-seated that I think we don't often think about it, but that's there. And again, I say the whole notion of monoculture agriculture is a profound expression of this, that you have one chosen crop and you kill everything else that might compete with it. And that's, so you basically, you and then you develop a crop as you did with Green Revolution and high-yielding rice, or now they're proposing golden rice, as same people doing the same thing over again, but trying to salvage something new, where you develop a crop which is utterly dependent on life support systems that are supplied by transnational corporations, whether it's from the patented seed to the agrotoxins to all the way through the system. And so we've created an agriculture and a food system which, in fact, is in an alien world, in fact, because it is the alien in the natural world, and it has no home anymore. It's completely dependent on the suppliers. So you can see the lockup that then exists from hybrid seeds first to patented seeds to Terminator to Gertz and so on, working its way through the system in terms of control of the crop and of the whole food system. But it comes, as I say, with industrial agriculture, we've seen it, and biotech is just the latest expression of the same and a most extreme expression of the same phenomena, same attitude. It's also an attitude that has a profound belief in progress. I was intrigued yesterday after a discussion that some of the people came up to question me. This was in somewhere else. And they said, the immediate response is, oh, you want us to go back. And I said, well, as a matter of fact, I am going back home today. This is a strange notion that we can only move forward or backward on a line that has been defined for us by somebody else. I say, on the contrary, if I'm headed for the cliff and I can see it, or I'm about to walk across the highway, I don't feel it incumbent on me to press forward and either walk off the cliff or into the path of a truck. And yet we've got, the minute you get into this discussion, it's either we go forward or we go back. And I would like to suggest, as I can here, we can go sideways, we can go in any number of directions. And one of the problems with biotech and this whole thing, because it's a monoculture model, is that there is only one way forward, and consequently only one way back to retreat. So we get locked into this kind of monoculture. But to put another way of expressing this, it seems to me to relate some of the history to, is to think of genetic engineering as the ultimate colonialism. By this I mean that one of the basic premises of biotechnology, of genetic engineering, and in fact of our broader culture, is no respect for boundaries. No respect for the integrity of an organism, whether it's the level of a gene or a human community, an ecology, a state, whatever. Boundaries are to be demolished. And it's interesting to see that you've got genetic engineering at one end, at the molecular end, and globalization at the other. Folks, it's the same project. The violation and destruction of boundaries for the benefit of the colonial powers, which is a handful of transnational corporations. And I'm sure that they're quite aware of what they're doing. And you look at the colonization now of Africa with biotech, and the fact that Monsanto trains, forgotten her name, Mwambugu, in St. Louis, and then she goes back and sets up the agency in Africa, in Kenya, to propagate that. And then they'll cite, and I'm sure you've seen it, if you read the industry stuff, you'll find Africans carefully chosen speaking up for biotech and how it is immoral for us of the affluent North to object to biotechnology because we need it. But if you go to Kenya, you would find down the road, and it's in the issue of the Ramshorn that's floating, or one of them, stories about the alternative projects. And I think, Tom, you're going to send something about this too, so that's fine. Okay, we've got linear progress. We've got the violation of boundaries. And basically, I think all this rests on a profound disrespect for creation. And I use the term very deliberately because I don't think, well, I mean, science does not create new life. It can play with what's there, but it does not create it. And I think what I would want to, the ground I want to stand on is saying that we need to start with the respect for life and the integrity of organisms, and then try to figure out how do we incorporate that, how do we respect that in our social constructs and the way we go about living, and that that's the only hope for us collectively as part of the global ecology. We're going to have to step out of this role of domination and control, because it's a loser. It requires bigger and bigger tanks and more weapons in order to maintain that. Fortunately, nature is very resilient, very forgiving, and it's probably more likely that we're the ones who will be the extinct species if we carry on than nature itself. But who knows? I would not want to be responsible for being a Pollyanna and saying, oh, well, don't worry about it. On the contrary, I think we do. But I think we have to worry more than about the whole system, and not in good ecological fashion, and not just genetic engineering, but see this as kind of the wake-up call. In fact, in Farmageddon, I played around with the notion of genetic engineering as a revelation. And look at it, how it is revealing to us the really unattractive side of our culture, and the fact that that's what we've got to come to terms with, and it's a collective task. That we are going to have to alter our whole way of thinking and our way of living if we're going to carry on, or we're going to continue to narrow the course into this monoculture dominated by a handful of corporations for a corporate profit. And I don't want to spend any more of my life than I have to dealing with that. I think there's more interesting things to do, but that's the agenda we have to face. So it's going to take a lot of hard work and a lot of homework to try and think these things through and figure out how we learn to live here and not in some fray land of our own mind's creation, as the industry would have it.
That was Bruce Terneen, author of Farmageddon, speaking last month in Vancouver, Canada.
We're next going to hear from Donald Gutstein. He's a senior lecturer and co-director of Newswatch Canada, a media monitoring project in the School of Communications at SFU. Newswatch has just completed a study of media coverage on GM foods. He is also author of three books, most recently Ecom, How the Internet Undermines Democracy.
Thanks for inviting me here today. And I'd like to share with you some of the research we've been doing at Newswatch Canada up at SFU regarding biotechnology. When I was listening to Brad lay out the propaganda messages that were coming from the Monsanto groups, I thought I was reading the National Post again, and because that's exactly what we've been looking at. I said, "Oh no, I read the National Post for research purposes only, right? So I don't want to have to do that more than I have to." But what I want to talk about today is another aspect of the corporate propaganda system for biotechnology, mainly the news media, and in particular, the National Post. By propaganda, I mean simply attempts to achieve a response in a target audience that furthers the intent of the propagandist. If propaganda is successful, we come to believe something that is in the interest of the propagandist, but not necessarily in our own interest. It's also known as advertising and public relations. And it's the opposite of education, where the intent is to encourage critical inquiry and to open minds to a variety of possibilities. And this is what public discussion of biotechnology should be about. Well, these thoughts came to my mind when I read a front page story in the National Post from July the 24th of this year. And Kenzie, could I have the first slide? Well, this was in the Vancouver Sun, is where I first saw it that morning. Biotech risks worth taking, Canadians say in national poll. And so what I'm going to do is tell you about this story and what I believe is behind it. Then I'm going to look at the National Post's coverage of biotechnology in general. And then third, depending on how much time I have, I want to situate Hollinger and the National Post in the larger propaganda system. So I saw this story, front page, Vancouver Sun. You know, at Newswatch Canada, we read the news critically, carefully. I said, why is this story in the paper today? Did something happen yesterday? Well, you read the story, you know, nothing happened yesterday. And in fact, a little later on, when I actually got a hold of the poll results had been submitted in January. So there was no reason for this story to be in the paper on that particular day, any reason that was obvious. Maybe something was happening with the in the Monsanto groups, I don't know. But my alarm bells went off. So I went to the National Post. It was also on the front page, and it was also in the Ottawa Citizen. The National Post, the headline says, "Majority immune to biotech health scare." And then, of course, poll. It says poll there. So it must be real, must be accurate. The majority of Canadians are prepared to accept unintended risks and surrender ethical concerns about advances in biotechnology as long as they lead to benefits in health, medical care, and the environment, according to a federal poll. And a little later, the National Post, in the fourth paragraph, takes the opportunity to attack environmentalists. The findings contradict the belief fostered by environmental groups, those fosterers, though, you know, that a growing number of Canadians distrust biotechnological advances. So the main finding overall was that British Columbians and all Canadians, in fact, are favorable to genetically modified foods, but want more testing and control. They throw out some numbers. 61% of us said we're comfortable with biotechnology, and 38% said we're uncomfortable with it. So this would be great news for the propagandists if it was true. However, when I saw that this poll had been done by Earnscliffe Research, my alarm bells did go off because I had come across Earnscliffe, their tactics in my research, in my book on e.com, on the information technology industry. And so I phoned Ottawa for the poll, and it was delivered to me a couple of days later. Public opinion research into biotechnology issues presented to the, here's a big mouthful, the Biotechnology Assistant Deputy Minister Coordinating Committee, which are the seven ministries in Ottawa that have some jurisdiction over biotechnology. And the worst news was that it was chaired by the Minister of Industry, which has really got nothing to do with food or health or anything, but they've been able to insinuate themselves into all of these areas and promote an industry agenda. What did the poll actually say compared to what Hollinger said the poll said? Well, it's true that 61% said they were comfortable, but more important, only 5% of Canadians said they were familiar with biotechnology at all. And only 2% of Canadians said they were very familiar with a regulatory system. So what Canadians were saying is we're comfortable with biotechnology, but you don't know anything about it. Okay? So you would think that Earnscliffe would recommend to the government a public education program to increase knowledge. Wrong. This is what Earnscliffe recommended in the study. A large-scale government communication strategy is a potentially risky proposition, one that could potentially trigger heightened public concern about biotechnology. That's on page 62. So in Earnscliffe's view, the more people know about biotechnology, the more concerned they're likely to become. Right? So that leads to the strategy that we see on the front page of the National Post and the other Hollinger papers. You reduce concerns by getting Hollinger and the other media, although the Globe and Mail didn't report on this, to write stories that claim that Canadians support biotech advances. So the reader sees it and says, oh, well, biotech must be okay if most people support it. And the only people really against it are those darn communists and environmentalist fosterers. Okay? So why might Earnscliffe recommend such an approach? For one reason, perhaps, because it's a leading Ottawa lobbying firm with dozens of clients, including two of Canada's largest biotech companies, Bristol-Myers Squibb and SmithKline Beecham. And the registered lobbyist for Earnscliffe, for those two companies, is a chap by the name of Michael Robinson. But he won't be working for those companies this month because he's busy working for the Liberals trying to get them reelected. He's been a Liberal insider since the 80s, and he was actually chair of the Paul Martin leadership campaign in 1990. Okay, so here's Earnscliffe doing extensive polling for the government, manipulating the results, and providing advice to Industry Canada based on the manipulated results. Industry Canada's biotech mandate, meanwhile, is to promote the industry and act as industry advocate. I think Brad pointed out that Industry Canada is one of the founders of Biotech Canada. One of the members, and I'm sure they played a role. So here they are, they're in a conflict of interest situation. They're supposed to be regulating or monitoring biotech developments, and meanwhile they're strong advocates for it. And then Earnscliffe is making big bucks promoting the corporate interests. And the question is, who's representing the public interest? And no one, as far as I can see. So the next question is this story typical of the National Post coverage of biotechnology? At Newswatch Canada, we did a study comparing the National Post and the Globe and Mail on a number of dimensions, one of which was biotechnology. And I want to acknowledge Scott Uselman, who's a grad student in the School of Communication, who did some of this analysis. So in 1999, here's what the National Post did. It gave hardly any coverage to biotechnology at all. 41 articles out of about 80,000 that year, or 1/50th of 1%. No wonder people don't know very much about biotechnology. Worse, it put most of its biotech reporting in the business section and not in the news section, meaning that it was news for investors, not for citizens. Which company should we invest in today, dear? You know, that kind of thing. Did not report once during 1999 on the ethical implications of biotechnology. Neither did the Globe and Mail, by the way. Nor did it report once on protests or direct actions against biotech developments. In contrast, the Globe and Mail devoted 10% of its coverage to those kinds of stories. And whose voices got to be heard in the few stories that the National Post did report on? Well, certainly not advocacy groups. What this table shows is the sources in the stories in the National Post and the Globe and Mail. You'll see that industry sources lead the way in both papers. The National Post was academics and scientists were the second most quoted source. Government was third, and advocacy was way down at 8.6%. And what's interesting is the difference here between the National Post and the Globe and Mail. The Globe and Mail, a quarter of its sources were from advocacy groups like Greenpeace and Sierra Club, whereas in the National Post, like about 1 in 12. And given that there's only 41 stories, we're talking about 9 times in 1999 were advocacy groups sourced in the National Post. But this is great. This is a model of balance and sanity compared to its editorial and opinion offerings, which were so distorted, misleading, and biased as to literally take your breath away. So the National Post gave us very little news about what was going on in biotechnology, but they gave us a lot of opinion about what they thought was going on in biotechnology. And what this shows is the first column, the number of news items in 1999. The second column is the number of opinion pieces in 1999. And then I've come up with some kind of ratio, the ratio of opinion pieces to news items. And you can see basically what it says: for every 10 news items in the National Post, there were 7 opinion pieces. And for every 10 news items in the Globe and Mail, there were roughly 2 opinion pieces, which seems a more reasonable kind of thing. So the National Post was obsessed with biotechnology, not in its news section, but it's in opinion pages. There were 29 items in all. 2 were negative towards biotechnology. 3 were neutral. They were telling us, explaining the problems faced by the industry. And 24 were positive towards biotechnology. Incredible distortion. The 2 that were negative, one was an opinion piece by a coalition of scientists presenting arguments against biotechnology. But this was immediately rebutted by another article on the same page on the same day by another coalition of scientists led by the University of Guelph that praised biotech foods. The other negative story was not actually an article, but a news release by the Sierra Youth Coalition outlining its strategies for a campaign against biotechnology. And it was negated by its headline, which said, Sierra's Halloween Food Scare. So of the 24 stories, pieces that were positive, Douglas Powell of University of Guelph had 4 of them. It was just bash the critics for the whole year. Biotech bashers, bullies, future fascisti, infantile, anti-science, alarmist, living in an apocalyptic and imaginary world, scaremongers, and so on. You get the idea. So opposition to genetically engineered foods was portrayed as a political issue, the product of sectarian and economic interests. Grassroots movements were regarded as fearmongers, as backward and irrational, the product of Luddism and outdated ideologies. Is this a coincidence or is there a pattern? Now, I'm out of time, but I want to put on the last slide, which we could discuss later, that what this tries to do is a preliminary attempt to situate Hollinger, the publisher of the National Post, within the larger propaganda system. And the lines represent interlocking directorships, if you will, say, for instance, between Hollinger and the Hudson Institute, which is on a campaign to attack organic foods. Mary Jose Kravis is a director of both. Where's the Fraser Institute connection? Of course, there's Hollinger publisher, David Radler, is a trustee of the Fraser Institute that has now got a new campaign against biotechnology. Archer Daniels Midland, one of the big food producers in the States, the Canadian Imperial Bank of Commerce, and I've even got a link to the Canadian Alliance, which is my hypothesis that Conrad Black not only created the Canadian Alliance, he also created Stockwell Day, both behind the scenes in the party back rooms, but also in the pages of the National Post. And of course, Archer Daniels Midland is big in Alberta, so I leave it, you know, if they get in, the possibilities are enormous for corporate propaganda. So the ideas that have been presented can be challenged and countered through sessions such as today's and disseminating these ideas into the public domain. But that is a topic for another day. So thank you very much.
That was Donald Gutstein of Newswatch Canada.
So our final presenter is Tony Clark. He is the director of the Polaris Institute of Canada, which is designed to enable citizen movements to develop new skills and tools for democratic social change in an age of corporate-driven globalization. Tony is the vice chair of the Council of Canadians and heads the Committee on Corporations for the International Forum on Globalization. He is author of The Silent Coup, Confronting the Big Business Takeover of Canada, MAI, the Multilateral Agreement on Investment and the Threat to Canadian Sovereignty, and most recently a booklet entitled By What Authority? Unmasking and Challenging the Global Corporations, Assault on Democracy Through the World Trade Organization.
Hello, everybody, and thanks again, like the others, for being and having an opportunity to be here. I have been traveling across the country from Central America over the last few hours, so I'm a little bit whacked out. But if you can bear with me, I'm sure we can make it. What a great, wonderful crowd you've got here, and it's just great to see the spirit here that's in the room. It's just wonderful. You've heard from Brad and Donald giving us an idea of not only the propaganda machinery, but some of the correlated lobbying machinery that's really behind the scenes to promote biotech and how relentless this machinery really is in terms of Canada. I'm going to take it a little bit further in terms of looking more at the biotech engines that are driving this agenda on a global scale, behind the scenes, the real gene giants that are pushing this and are benefiting most from the buildup of this biotech industry and the so-called life science industry, and to talk a little bit about what's really happening on that scene. You may remember, of course, with all the protests that occurred in Europe and here in North America, it looked like Monsanto a year ago was on the ropes. Monsanto, certainly its stock had plunged, and it looked like it was going to be picked apart in terms of fireside sales, and we would see perhaps the end of Monsanto, and a lot of people thought the end of the biotech industry. Well, not quite so. And I just want to read a quote from something called the Ag Bio Forum. The editor of that said, and he happened to be he just happened to be a professor that was closely linked with the Monsanto. But here is what he had to say at that time when all that pressure was going on. Ag biotech is not going away. I just think it's for the next 5 years, it will have to prove itself on its own. You're looking at a technology with a life cycle of 100+ years that's just beginning. And I think it's important for us just to take a moment to reflect a little bit on that, simply because I think it's instructive for those that are engaged in campaigns on genetically engineered foods to also understand or to try to track what's really going on in the industry itself and the corporations themselves. And we've been trying to do this through the work that we're doing in the Polaris Institute. We have a program called Gearing Up for the Biotech Century, and within that program we have a particular project that we're working on at the present time, which is called Cosmetic Biotech Surgery. And the purpose of this is to really try to help campaign activists understand the extent to which the biotech corporations are remaking themselves. They are, in fact, in response to the protest and in response to the public pressure that's been out there, they've been going through their own restructuring. And they've been doing this according to at least five-year plans and in some cases 10-year plans, looking ahead, knowing very well that they have to stay in the game and what they have to do to stay in the game in order to survive, etc. So in this process, we've been trying to take a look at the major biotech corporations, apply a methodology which we have in the Polaris Institute called the corporate X-ray methodology, in which we strategically dissect a corporation in the context of the industry itself and try to identify its strengths and weaknesses and its vulnerabilities in order to be able to help campaign activists choose the kinds of strategies and tactics that may be most effective. In the context of that corporate X-ray methodology, we have something called strategic trend lines. And it's by looking at where the industry is at and where the corporations are at and looking ahead 5 years from now and trying to figure out what they're trying to do and how they're trying to get there and what kind of moves that they're trying to make in order to be able to accomplish that. With the enormous protests that have built up around whether it's Monsanto as a target or Novartis as a target or AstraZeneca as a target in Europe, the fact is these biotech corporations, these big engines of the biotech industry, began to reestablish themselves and reorganize themselves in new ways. And they took this long-term view, and they know how to do this because many of these corporations, after all, started off as being chemical corporations. And then they had to somehow remake themselves into biotech corporations, but then they had to make themselves again into friendly biotech corporations, and that's the kind of strategy that is going on at the present time. So, Kenzie, if we could have the first chart for a moment. This just gives you an idea of some of the major players we're looking at. And the first three of those, Aventis, Novartis, and DuPont, by the way, rate between 50 and 60 on the global Fortune 500 index. So it shows you we're dealing with some fairly powerful players in terms of overall large corporations. We've been tracking these corporations. The main ones, the first six or the big six that we've been tracking are Aventis, BASF, DuPont, Novartis, Pharmacia, which is now Monsanto, and then on top of that, Bayer and Dow Chemical and other corporations as well. But those are the main ones that we have been tracking, and these are most of the gene giants that are in the life science industry. Now, I'm going to identify five strategic trend lines which are designed to restructure those corporations and their image and to remake themselves so that they're going to look quite different 5 years from now. The first of these trend lines is what they call agrochemical mergers and spin-offs. In December of 1999, last year, both Monsanto and AstraZeneca plus Novartis made some quite dramatic announcements. Monsanto, as you know, was in deep trouble. It announced the fact that it was going to merge with Pharmacia Upjohn to form a new corporation, which then became known as the Pharmacia Corporation. But in doing so, they were going to spin off their agrochemical operations, still allow the name Monsanto to be applied to those agrochemical corporations, but the agrochemical part would be spun off on its own track and still controlled 80% by the new corporation, Pharmacia Corporation. The same time, AstraZeneca and Novartis announced that they were going to merge their agrochemical operations into a new corporation called Synergentia. Synergenta down there in the column about just towards the end there, Synergenta, as a new corporation which would free up Novartis and AstraZeneca to concentrate much more on their pharmaceutical operations. Now the purpose of this is to separate both the agrochemical from the pharmaceutical part, mainly because the pharmaceutical part really brings in a great deal of revenue. But this is also clearly understood in the statements that were made that this was only going to be a temporary separation. And furthermore, the parent corporation still controlled the agrochemical operations and could rein them in whenever it was necessary to do so. Their intent, of course, is that 5 years from now, the GE market will have reopened again on the food front, and they will be able to reposition themselves accordingly along those lines. But we'll get there in a second. The second trend line has to do with the consolidation of the pharmaceuticals. And Kenzie, if we could go to the next chart for just a moment, please. What these corporations have done, these gene giants have done, is that they know very well that the public accepts the importance of life-saving drugs and drugs that are going to overcome pain and ailment, ailments of one kind or another. And so the fact is that these corporations have not only been in the area, operating in the area of GE foods, they've also had very strong pharmaceutical components. And those pharmaceutical components, especially with the blockbuster drugs that have come on the market, have been real money makers for these corporations. The thing that saved Monsanto's bacon, quite frankly, was a drug called Celebrex, which was used for arthritis purposes, came on the market in the early part of 1999, and really produced a bonanza of revenue that allowed Monsanto to survive through that very heavy period where its Roundup Ready was product was in trouble. And so it's very important, I think, that we understand that they have these this pharmaceutical component. And what they've done now, and by the way, these pharmaceutical drugs that they produce do use the same technology, the same basic technology of genetic engineering. And so what's happened is that Novartis Pharmacia, AstraZeneca, those kind of corporations have repositioned themselves now by strengthening their healthcare components. And so you can see that there's an awful lot more investment going in on their drug side. And if you saw the previous chart in comparison to the agricultural side, you can see that there's a considerable amount of emphasis in that direction. So the consolidation of the pharmaceutical part and the healthcare part is a really big part of their survival strategy. The third trend line is has to do with divesting of their petrochemical operations. And once again, remember that most, not all, but most of the big gene giants have come out of a chemical industry background. But they're now divesting of some of those operations, at least it appears that way, in order to be able to kind of create a kind of green image. And Kenzie, if we could go to the next chart, we'll see a little bit of this. In the sense of the divesting of petrochemical and non-specialty chemical products that they're engaged in order to be able to produce this kind of green image. DuPont, for example, who we all know is a huge chemical giant on the global scene, has sold its petrochemical operations called Conoco for $4.4 billion in May of 1999. And in doing so, it set up a way of, first of all, started to buy up some pharmaceutical corporations and to start to consolidate some interest in pharmaceutical operations. Imagine that, DuPont becoming a healthcare corporation. Doesn't quite live with most of us. But at the same time, they also bought up Pioneer Seed, they also bought up Pioneer Seed at that time and became the largest seed company in the world at that time as well. So they've been divesting in their petrochemicals and shifting to the seed and shifting to the other operations. The fourth trend line has to do with strengthening the human genome and partnerships that they've been working on, and that has been an area where they are now trying to remake themselves very much as life science corporations by buying up and developing strategic partnerships now with small genomic companies that are tracing and tracking the genetic code and providing that data on a private sale basis to companies that want information on data regarding the human genetic code, data regarding other plants and animals as a part of their buildup of knowledge that they're going to be utilizing for their particular industries. So there's a whole shift now towards the genomic industry, and these corporations are in a position are positioning themselves now to move into this area in big time, certainly 5 years from now, and to have a big impact in terms of remaking themselves as life science industries for the future. And the final thing, and the coup de grace on all of this, of course, is that they haven't given up on genetically engineered foods at all. The fifth trend line is the fact that they now see themselves shifting their genetically engineered food products right smack into the third world, because they, of course, believe that they can feed the world's hungry by moving in this direction. And if we go to the final chart, we will see an indication of the moves that have been made in a number of different countries to actually build up crop and crop developments in a number of those different countries. Just to give you a quick example, AstraZeneca is into the golden rice, the nutraceutical, the third generation, and the development of vitamin A enhanced rice. They're definitely into that area, as is Monsanto. Novartis is moving in that area in terms of Vietnam, Malaysia, and the Philippines. You have big emphasis with Aventis coming in and operating in Madagascar, Colombia, Brazil, and China. So the corporations are moving and positioning themselves very well in terms of that third world market, and that's what they see happening over the next 5 years. By that time, they feel they'll be over the hump in terms of Europe, and they will have made sure that they've maintained control on the market and consumer attitudes here in North America. And so that's what we're up against over the next 5 years. They hope at the end to come out of that 5 years from now in a position where they will have refocused GE food production on third world markets, consolidated their operation as life science corporations with a strong emphasis on the pharmaceuticals, and with this human genome projects coming on stream, and finally that to reposition themselves to re-enter both the European, Japanese, as well as the North American markets in big time at that point. One final thing, and we can leave this right now. The other thing that we're tracking all five of those trend lines, and watching what's happening with those trend lines. Secondly, we're also looking at the big question of who will own the biotech and gene giants 5 years from now. And here's the question I'll leave you with. Is it going to be the big pharmaceutical giants? If we look back at the chart a few moments ago, you'll see that there are other big pharmaceutical giants besides the ones that are into genetic engineering and genetic engineering products. Will it be the big pharmaceutical giants, or will it be the big food conglomerates like Nestle's, Conagra, Sara Lee, and those kinds of corporations? That's going to be the question 5 years from now, whether the gene giants will be gobbled up by one of those two major industries. Thank you very much.
That was Tony Clark of the Polaris Institute of Canada. The preceding speakers were part of a forum on biotechnology, Big Money, Bad Science, that took place in Vancouver, British Columbia last month. Thanks to the Vancouver Independent Media Center for that tape.
Ladies and gentlemen, we have a news bulletin in. It seems there has been an outbreak of civil disturbances at the North Pole. For details, we take you now to the San Francisco Liberation Radio newsroom with anchorman Steve Zingerzanger.
Yes, this is Steve Zingerzanger in the San Francisco Liberation Radio newsroom. The North Pole is in turmoil tonight. Rioting has broke out among Santa's elves. It seems the elves are upset about recent plans to shut down the North Pole toy factory and move it to Immaculadora in Mexico. For details on this story, we go now to our reporter, Wendy Space Cadet, who's at the North Pole. Wendy, what can you tell us?
Steve, thousands of Santa's elves are in the streets tonight. Windows have been smashed, trash cans lit on fire, and elves protesting have clashed with police. Trouble first started brewing last week when elves, resting up after a heavy Christmas rush, were startled with the announcement that nearly two-thirds of the workforce would be actually laid off. In the early morning hours after the Christmas holidays, Santa Claus Incorporated unveiled plans to shut down the North Pole factory and reopen in Mexico. The announcement was greeted with anger by the elves.
They ask us to work hard, we work hard. They ask us to work harder, we work harder. They ask us to work longer hours, we work longer hours. They ask us to work for less pay, we work for less pay. Now they tell us we have no more jobs, only they tell us after Christmas instead of before. So we work hard, hard, hard and not spoil Christmas. Now we are mad, 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 mad.
Part of the unrest stems from the fact that elves have been asked to take 3 pay cuts in the last 2 years, while Santa Claus Incorporated has posted record profits of $33 billion. Many of the elves say they are now one paycheck away from being homeless.
I don't know what we're gonna do. My 3 kids have to eat, you know, my wife needs an operation. What do we do now? I don't know. I'm all messed up. My father was an elf. My grandfather was an elf. His father before him was an elf. My family, we've always been elves. Now what am I going to do? I don't know. I don't know. I'm just messed up right now.
We spoke to Santa Claus himself this morning, and he said accusations that the company has treated the elves unfairly are not true. And he accused the elves of being terrorist drug dealers.
They are criminals and should be dealt with as such. Besides, I don't know what they're so worried about. There are plenty of jobs around. Let them go to work at McDonald's.
As CEO of Santa Claus Incorporated, Santa makes a very comfortable $110 million a year, including bonus packages and stock options. We asked him if there was anything at all the company could do to help the elves.
Unfortunately not. It's a matter of hard economics. The Mexican elves are simply willing to work for less money. We do this, of course, so we can pass along savings to the consumer.
But Santa, prices have been going up instead of down.
Don't bother me with details.
The government here at the North Pole, which recently joined the U.S., Canada, and Mexico in signing on to the North American Free Trade Agreement, has been hiring new police and building prisons and jails at an astonishing rate. The fact that it has done so while planning stories in the press about rising crime rates was dismissed today by the government spokesperson as just being a coincidence.
Well, geez, criminals are, running rampant. I mean, golly, everybody says so, and I mean, and we have these statistics and all.
Who compiled the statistics?
Well, the government, of course.
And that's pretty much the story from here. Whoops, wait a minute. We have this late word in. The North Pole National Guard has been activated. Yes, we have that confirmed now. The military is being called in to handle the situation. At a press conference at the Presidential Palace just moments ago, officials announced that their first concern is public safety, and that's why they're sending 25,000 troops armed with M16 rifles, tanks, and helicopter gunships firing laser-guided missiles for public safety. And I think we can all understand that. And Steve, as I stand here, the street behind me, which was once filled with little tiny elf bicycles ridden by little tiny elves on their way to and from work, is now filling up with tanks and troops. But the elves say they are not intimidated. They say they will stick to their demands. They want their jobs back. And a tense showdown seems to be developing. We cut now to the live action.
Pause now for a commercial. Kleenex Ultra Tissues. An extra layer of softness makes them thicker than other Ultra Tissues.
And the prince lived happily ever after?
How did you know?
Kleenex Ultra's Ultra Softness for a sore nose.
President Clinton said today there's absolutely no truth to charges that he or his wife Hillary acted improperly in dealings with the Whitewater real estate venture. Meanwhile, the scandal continued to intensify. For a report on that, we go now
to... Wait a minute! Wait a minute! What happened to the elves?
Who?
The elves!
What elves?
The elves you were just reporting on.
Oh, those elves. Ah, well, it wasn't really that newsworthy.
What do you mean it wasn't newsworthy?
Here. Oh, what's the problem?
Who are you?
I'm J. Tycoon Wentworth, executive director of Network News. How may I help you?
I want to know what happened to the elves.
What elves?
The elves at the North Pole who are rioting because they lost their jobs because of NAFTA.
Steve? Do you know anything about this?
Well, sort of. I think there were some elves who were unhappy about something or other.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, why are you suppressing that story?
We're not suppressing it. We just decided not to report on it anymore.
But why?
Those elves... Nobody cares about them or their petty, if you'll pardon the pun, little problems.
I can't believe this.
If you'll excuse us, please.
Yeah, sure.
These people and their complaints. Now, how is tonight's newscast shaping up?
Well, the president visited a flag factory today.
Oh, good. We'll lead with that.
And we have a story on an 80-year-old man who's been growing apples with pesticides for 30 years and says there's nothing wrong with it.
Oh, excellent. A human interest story. I like that. Do we have any fresh material on Madonna or Michael Jackson? How about some sports?